Radio Riva, Brighton Festivals Now. All of the news, reviews, and what not to miss at Brighton Festival with Melissa Dennett and Rebecca Sandals. On Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, the only station on air with a dedicated Brighton Festival Hour.
You listen to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM on DAB and online at radioreverb.com. I'm Melissa Dennett. This is Tuesday's Brighton Festival special. We're here Monday to Friday during the festival, 5 to 6pm, repeated 10pm, then 9am the next day.
And I'm Rebecca Sandals, and right through the festival, we're looking behind the scenes, meeting some of the performers, creators, and the people who make it happen. Today, we're looking ahead to a musical show which asks questions about who performs disability on stage and screen.
We'll be finding out about a performance which explores paranormal activity, loss and resurrection, and black identities.
And we'll be hearing how an installation made of plastic jerry cans is helping to transform communities in Ghana.
And much more in the next hour here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. Rebecca, we are almost halfway through the festival. I can't believe it.
It flies by. It flies by in a daze, and occasionally we get the day right of the show and occasionally we don't, but that's festival.
Yeah, managed to do that right today, actually. That's a rarity. I can never remember which day of the week it is. So we are here, Rebecca Sandals and I, to guide you gently but firmly by the hand through that Brighton Festival programme. So if you look at it and you feel a little bit flummoxed and you look at something, you think, not sure, what might that be about? That is our job, to lead you through. We're taking you behind the scenes, meeting some of the people who make the festival tick. Artists, performers, and the creators. So, you were talking to your mum, weren't you, about this? I love your mum. Your mum always pops up on the programme at some point.
We try not to bring her in because she can be quite grumpy and negative about things, and we like to keep things a bit positive. But she said to me, I was listening to that the other day, and you had that. No, that doesn't sound like my mum at all.
That doesn't sound like your mum, no. Anyway, keep the voice.
So I was listening to the other day and Melita was talking to someone about that show Eye to Eye. Now, I'd seen it in the programme and I thought, I don't really fancy that. But then I listened to the piece and I thought, how interesting. And I heard the woman and her daughter speaking and I thought, that sounded really interesting. And I'd missed it by then. But so, yeah, well.
Well, that will learn, won't it? That will learn. So this is what we're here for, you know. So if it works for Rebecca's mum, it hopefully will work for you as well. We've got a jam-packed programme today. I went to see Gonzalez last night. To me, that was a show of two-thirds. So we'll talk about that later on. And we've got a whole bunch of people who are going to be appearing at the Brighton Festival this week for you.
Now, on Monday's Festival Radio Show, we heard all about three different Brighton Festival shows taking place at the Attenborough Centre for Creative Arts. Now, the first of these is on Thursday and Friday of this week, performed by Jamil Ulawule Kozoko. Seances explores paranormal activity, loss and resurrection, and black identities using movement, song, spoken word, and live score. Now, Jamil is a curator, poet, and performance artist from Detroit, Michigan, and we're delighted to have him here in the studio. So before we talk about that show, you had a workshop earlier today at the Marlborough here in Brighton. Tell us about that.
Yeah. It was a really lovely group of artists coming from, you know, London and Brighton and sort of, you know, Sussex, University of Sussex. And we really got to just think together as a community around certain issues of transgression and sort of the embodiment of that, and also ways in which we might subvert normalized structures as they exist around us, and kind of making them more plain and using certain materials to kind of manipulate.
Is that structures, when you're talking about how people respond to us as individuals or within society? Or?
Exactly. Some of these more invisibilized structures that exist around bodies that may appear different or neurodiverse or whatever the case may be. Just thinking about how we are able to think about ourselves and proximity to these systems and how we may be able to move beyond and, I guess, realize ourselves more fully in that spectrum.
So we are going to talk about seances in a tick, which is why we've got you here. But I was wondering if doing that kind of that mentoring, these kind of workshops and performance, and bringing people in who aren't performers, but you know, getting them thinking into that performing mind space, feeds into your own work and inspires you. And I guess you pick up some other stories as well.
Of course. It's I use workshops as a way of certainly exploring questions and certain thematics that I'm just interested in any given moment. And so it's a way to kind of test, you know, maybe a score or a movement, you know, possibility on an ensemble, just to see how something is sort of percolating and activating, you know what I mean? So I totally use the workshop environment almost as a research environment for my own work and my own, you know, line of study.
How different are those people here in the UK to Americans?
Yes.
Yeah, I just think there must be a bit of a difference. But
well, it seems a bit more, I want to say straightforward here. I don't know quite what I mean when I say that. I think I think the people kind of expect things to be kind of revealed in a very specific way or something.
Well, the English like it to be said as it is.
Yeah, I think there's something about a kind of straightforwardness, like do this or something. And I'm more curious about allowing more space and possibility. And so people can tend to enter the space and feel a little uncomfortable with the amount of openness that is available, because I find that a lot of participants here really want to be told what to do, and I'm more interested in us exploring a thing and conjuring together what the possibilities of an environment can be, less sort of dictating like what should be done. So it's just a stylistic shift that I'm noticing, you know. Yeah.
Do you enjoy that?
Well, it's educational in the least. You know, I'm learning how to engage with a number of different people, and I teach all over the world, so it's always a way of embarking on new territory and exploring. So what does this space, this particular sort of configuration of people have to offer in this moment? You know, and we just explore that together. So, yeah.
Now, before we talk about seances, I just want, I had a little look on your website, and there was a phrase that jumped out at me that I wanted to kind of question you on.
Well,
it says, and I quote, his work in, I'll do my radio voice for you.
Do that radio voice.
Okay, here we go. His work in performance is rooted in a creative mission to push history forward through writing and art making and advocacy.
Sure. Yeah.
Pushing history forward, yeah. I thought to myself. Now, that is quite a mission.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that...
I mean, we live in such an age of cultural amnesia. You know, we especially with the work that I'm making, which can be really difficult for sort of, you know, contemporary, you know, modernized individuals. It's almost as if, you know, us in the modern world, we want to forget, you know, the project of colonization. We want to forget the messy historical relics that essentially allow us to be in the world the way we are. So I'm encouraging us to really to unpack what modernity means, like how we've come to be in this specific time and place in the contemporary moment, what systems and structures historically have allowed us to exist in this way in which we do, this more civilized, quote unquote, and I'm using air quotes, which is to say, you know, what makes this civilization any more important than previous civilizations that have been colonized or erased or eradicated, disinvested, whatever the case may be. And so for me, so much of what performance for me is doing, it allows me a way to delve into not only my history, but to the varying histories that circulate around me and interrogate them simultaneously. And essentially the stage becomes a platform for that investigation in the public domain.
So it's really that we're only here with a future because of a past, and so we have to acknowledge
that. Say it again.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
So
yes.
it's I could talk more about that, but we probably should talk about seances a little bit. It's a piece born out of personal tragedy.
Yeah, a lot of personal trauma, but also public as well. we all endure loss. You know, loss is not a singular experiment by no means. It's something that we experience in community, but we rarely acknowledge or want to acknowledge it. I find in the Western world, we've not really honed our grieving practice, our mourning practice.
We hold it in and explode.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what we do, right? You know?
What's wrong with that?
Exactly. Whereas in, you know, a number of cultures, I mean, you have, mourning songs. You have,
the
Day of the Dead. You have people that wear all black for, you know, weeks, months. You have these rituals in place for a reason, to help us to deal with certain losses. And I find that I had to really go about not only finding my own ritual, but essentially creating a kind of ceremonial that I could invite a number of others into, so that we could engage in this idea, this concept, this practice in community.
And at which point does the creation of a performance piece based around your own personal loss cross that line from the emotion and the feelings that originally provoked that piece crosses the line, and then it becomes purely a performance piece, that it is something you're performing rather than kind of reliving that emotion?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, and it's something that I continue to grapple with. I don't know if it ever fully turns over into the other. But I do know it is very much a production. And no matter what the content might be, it is, you know, it's an experience. I mean, there's a beautiful sound score composed by Jeremy Toussaint Baptiste. The work has been deeply dramaturgicalized, if that's such a word.
It is now.
I create words.
Oh,
just so
great.
We're aware, I create words. But the work is very much, you know, it's a show. It is a production. It just has this very weighted central core in its belly.
It's specifically looking at loss from the perspective of a black person. Now, if I go along as a white person, how would my response be different to a black woman who might be sitting next to me of the same age? What would you imagine?
That's a great question, and I don't know if I can necessarily answer it, but what I do know...
I'll go along with a black woman and find out, maybe. It's the only way I'll know.
I mean, that's a way to do it. But what I do know is, again, this idea or this feeling of loss is universal, and that has been what many folks gravitate to, because I find that like a lot of people, not only artists, creators, but we're looking to the to creative community as a space to deal with real circumstance, with what's really happening in the world. We want to come together to figure some of these things out in public space, and public in a sort of public inquiry. And so I think there makes no better, you know, platform than the performance space to really think about these things critically as an ensemble, as a group of people. You know, one of the first things that I do is engage in a kind of open source dialogue with a guest seancer. And in this case, it's Season Butler, who has a lovely novel coming out, Signet. And, you know, is a theorist and just really interesting, you know, scholar and friend at this point. We've really grown quite a liking towards each other over the past several months. And so this is an opportunity for us to also be in conversation and unpack these questions in front of a, you know, eclectic, diverse, racially diverse room of people. And so embedded in the work is this sort of inquiry and conversation, so we can delve into these questions, you know, literally together as we convene.
And of course, as you said, Seances is a performance. I mean, I haven't seen it yet. Mm-hmm. It looks stunning.
Yeah,
so the use
you.
Of costumes,
yeah.
masks, you've mentioned the music.
Yes.
It looks like it blurs gender boundaries
of
as
course.
Well. It looks like there's a lot of things
a
going
lot
on,
of boundaries.
Which would just be visually spectacular.
Yeah. It's I mean, I'm really proud of the work. I struggled with the proscenium for a while. Because I make very experimental, you know, niche work. So the fact that it tours as extensively as it does internationally still kind of, I'm like, well, how is this happening right now? But
is this the third year you've been touring with it?
Second.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
My second year now. And I think, you know, this is the finale. I think we've come to a natural pause at this point with the production. Not to say that I won't take, you know, other commissions to do a show. I mean, but it feels like it's coming to a natural pause.
See it this week. You might not get another
you
chance
may not
for
get
a while.
Another yeah. chance, yeah. you know? I mean, you know, Berlin loved it. Switzerland loved it. You know, New
Brighton
York.
Brighton will love it.
Brighton will love it. but no, but yeah, it's been quite an experience taking this thing, you know, all over and engaging with all different kinds of people and recognizing that, yes, there is this universal feeling, you know, that we are all moving through in our own way. And so why not put it, you know, in the public space and allow us to all figure it out together. But it is very much a spectacle. You know, I love costume. I love, you know, fabric and just sound and wigs and
that does come across
the
in
things.
The promo video
exactly.
on brightonfestival.org.
I'm having
I have
a lot
to say.
Of fun. I don't know if anyone else is having as much fun as I'm having, but I'm having a lot of fun on that stage. So, yeah.
Well, that's quite a good way to be dealing with bereavement and death.
Oh, we have to celebrate it. You know, it's a part of life.
If you smile and you've recently lost someone,
yeah.
I think there's a sense that people kind of look at you as if to say, "Ooh, how can they be happy?"
Mm.
And people forget that the normal human emotions carry on,
of course,
in the midst of horrendous situations.
Of course. You know, I in the process of making this work, you know, I lost my dad, and it forced me to really contend with this idea of post-traumatic enlightenment. You know, what happens after we've gone through, you know, the deep depths that is exposed when you've lost someone? You know, it's almost like I think death has a way of shaking the carpet loose shakes up the carpet and all of the free radicals that were just swept under the rug kind of just come out, and you're forced to deal with it and see it. And some of us can see it, and it can be stunning under a beautiful light. But others is like,
get the Hoover out. Get the Hoover out straight away.
Exactly. You know, let's clean this up. Let's get it, you know.
I don't want to look at it.
Don't
want to
look at it. Exactly. You know, and so I think there's a way that we can do both in a way. You know, we can clean, but we can also enjoy that process of cleaning. I had not expected to go into the metaphor of cleaning as a way of dealing with bereavement. But, you know, that'll work, I guess. You know, we're cleaning house.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, my father died on Sunday, and there's been a lot of stuff going around in my family, and that metaphor of shaking the carpet, absolutely, I'll tell you, there's a whole lot of
there's a lot of that rug, right?
A lot floating around at the
Should
moment.
Should we all come around with our hoovers?
Yes. Please do.
You know, it's real. My condolences, though.
Well, like, you know, it's like things happen, don't they?
It happens,
Especially when you reach a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, it seems strange finishing the interview now. We should be having a bit of a counselling session with Melita, but we're not going to. We're going to move on.
I don't need it. I just go to the pub with my mates.
All right.
We're just going to move on.
But
pubbing. We will be doing that.
Yes.
But not at 8 p.m. Thursday and Friday. Mm-hmm. Not for you, anyway.
Yeah, you want to come to ACCA. You need to be together.
So, seances, 8 p.m. this Thursday and Friday at the Attenborough Centre for the Creative Arts. Just a hop, skip and a jump away in Falmer. And Jamil, thank you so much for coming in and talking about the show. It's been fascinating.
Such a pleasure. I hope to do it again.
Yeah, it's been brilliant having you here. And looking forward to it. It looks fantastic.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, terrific. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Reverb.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
You're listening to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. This is the Brighton Festival special show with Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals. I'm looking ahead now to Saturday and Dream Monday, Bamanan Duro. That's a show that presents new Malian musicians playing traditional Malian music interwoven with the songs of Jacques Brel. Sounds unlikely, but apparently that's it. Miriam McCabe, Fela Kuti and Bob Marley. Taking place at the Dome on Sunday at 8. Let us have a flavour of that. Gorgeous music there. That is coming up on Saturday at Brighton Dome. That is Dream Monday, Bamanan Duro, a show presenting Malian musicians playing traditional music, plus the works of Jacques Brel, Miriam McCabe, Fela Kuti, Bob Marley, and more at the Dome on Saturday at 8. Rewind. I'll just glance through the festival programme.
You have a quick check.
It's on Saturday. There we go. We have our handy festival guide right in front of us, not what I've written there on my bit of paper. This is Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, mostly getting things right on the Brighton Festival show, but not always.
And it's Melita Dennett. She's the one getting it right, not always, but mostly. And I'm Rebecca Sandals. Shall we have a look at some things that are coming up in the next, like, 24 hours at
the
festival?
Yes, yeah. Let's. And let's get the dates and dates
we'll
right.
Give it a go. Now, let's start with Lines from a Wanderer. This is the internationally acclaimed baritone Marcus Farnsworth and the pianist Libby Burgess perform a collection of songs that explore places, journeys and wanderings. John Caskin's Lines from a Wanderer, a song cycle that includes settings of poems by Yeats, Browning and Hardy, is flanked by Schubert and English folk songs arranged by Britten. And that's a lunchtime concert at the All Saints Church this Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Now, one I'm really looking forward to is Backbone. It's done by Australian circus company Gravity and Other Myths. And as far as I'm concerned, the Australians who do a kind of circus and that physical performance can do no wrong. We've had some amazing Australian combos coming here to the Brighton Festival. They're coming to Brighton Dome Wednesday to Friday this week. They've got a lot to live up to with my high expectations. But the show Backbone takes the concept and perception of strength and literally tosses it into the air. The company tumble, backflip and walk across each other's heads. I like that kind of thing. Backbone explores the limits of emotion and physical endurance. So be ready for a piece of physical theatre that will make you proud to be human. 7:30 Wednesday, Thursday and Friday this week at the Dome. And there's a Friday matinee as well.
Now, finally, for tomorrow evening, the New Dystopians. It's over in the literature strand of this year's festival. And Wednesday evening sees the event titled New Dystopians. Two hugely anticipated debut novels, Signet by Susan Butler and The Farm by Joanne Ramos, give us a glimpse of what unsettling futures might await us in an age of easy travel and endlessly accessible technology. And you can hear directly from both the authors at 8 p.m. on Wednesday at Brighton and Hove High School. And Susan Butler will be joining us on tomorrow's show, I believe.
And she's also part of Seances. So there we go. So we get a double whammy with her. We'll ask her about seances. This
Absolutely.
Is Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, Brighton Festival special with Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals. Now, this show sold out in Edinburgh last year. It had rave 5-star reviews. It's called My Left Right Foot. It's a musical that has been described as a riotously funny, often potty-mouthed takedown of actorly pretensions and daft assumptions that able-bodied folk make about those with disabilities. It's a collaboration between Birds of Paradise Company and National Theatre of Scotland, who are no strangers to the Brighton Festival. It centres around the story of a staging by an amateur dramatic company of a performance of My Left Foot and the issues that throws up about able-bodied actors playing disabled roles. It may well, by the sounds of it, leave parts of the audience squirming as they confront their own prejudices and awkwardness around disability. Well, My Left Right Foot opens at the Theatre Royal tonight, so that's Tuesday, runs through to Saturday, and I went to the theatre earlier to meet writer and director Robert Softley-Gale and actors Richard Conlon and Gail Watson.
Right, what's this new inclusive show going to be about then?
My Left Foot. Oh, it's such an inspiring story.
What's the unique thing about this show?
Everyone's heard of it.
Hello, I'm Richard Conlon, and I play Ian, who's a member of the Kirktoon Players, an amateur dramatics company in Scotland.
My name is Gail Watson. I play Sheena Michaels, and I'm also a member of the Kirktoon Players.
And I'm Robert Coffey Gale. I'm the writer and director of the show.
This is a show which tackles the thorny issue of able-bodied actors playing actors with disabilities. So, you know, the title suggests it was inspired by the controversy around Daniel Day-Lewis playing a person with a disability in My Left Foot. Can you take it from there? Can you set the scene for me?
Well, for me, growing up in the 80s when My Left Foot came out, as a young guy with cerebral palsy, I was aware that My Left Foot was like the only representation of disability that I saw in film. But that was played by a non-disabled actor, and she got so much praise and got logic for playing that part. And in some ways, rightfully so, he did it very well. But there's something a bit weird about all of that. So this show is really about asking them questions and going, well, who's got the right to play those parts? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but we've seen quite a lot of fun asking the questions.
Right. It poses a really important question about who has the right to play those parts, and how does the piece then tackle those questions?
To add what Robert's saying, we have spent many hours in rehearsals going, Robert, what's the message? What is the answer? And the truth is, we really can't come up with the answer, because at the end of the day, it really is just about respecting people and just being kind to people no matter what you are. I don't know, I think at times to stand there on a big pedestal trying to bang a drum is not the way of doing it, because we're not sure what the answer is.
Very much because of the style of the show, it's not soapboxy at all. In fact, it's very reverential and very rude.
And,
very rude, and there's a lot of comedy,
rude.
And the singing. We're actually thinking of, like, if it became more popular and took off, there's not one song that would be able to play on Elaine Page on Sunday, because you'd have to edit every song, because they're just filth. But it's funny filth, and it's, yeah, people come along and have a really good time, so it doesn't feel like we're preaching to them ever. It's always done through comedy.
Yeah. See, I don't think the songs are filth. I'm going to disagree with you.
That's not a surprise.
Do you know what's great about it? It's how able-bodied people, are we allowed to, is that what we're called, Robert?
Whatever you like.
Yeah.
Right, so it's about able-bodied people and how they get it wrong, but it's also about disabled people and how they're getting it wrong. And sometimes the chip that we all have, and that still exists within the disabled community, that kind of chip on the shoulder. And it's not about shocking people. It's how people get it wrong.
Because all these characters that we play, they are all desperate to get this right. They think they are doing everything so politically correct and getting it all. They think they're brilliant at it. But for an audience watching, it can be quite an uncomfortable viewing, in a funny way. But you can see the able-bodied people in the audience sort of cringing, and the disabled people killing themselves laughing. And then that gives the able-bodied people permission then to laugh. Okay, no, we can laugh at this.
And there's that question for me of you. If what we do is offensive, but what Gail and Gail Lewis get isn't offensive, why is that? What's the difference? Who gets to decide, you know? So, yeah, we're all geeks about asking questions. I think the interesting thing is that the most people who are shocked by the show are non-disabled people who feel uncomfortable. Most disabled people that I speak to who see it think it's spot on, and they get, almost doesn't go far enough. So that's an interesting mix. Yeah.
It doesn't go far enough, wow.
But the thing is, there's a bit in it as well where the main actor within the company, he's creeping up for the first time in front of a mirror. We're on stage, so I'm watching the audience at that point. But I shouldn't tell you that. But I'm just looking at the audience reaction to it, and you can see them squirming and laughing, but not feeling like they can laugh. And then you speak to them afterwards and say, well, what do you think these able-bodied actors did when, you know, when they were playing Stephen Hawking, when they're playing Christy Brown, when they're playing these people? They will have done exactly what you just witnessed, but they did it in the privacy, but they've still done it. So, you know, it is an uncomfortable viewing, and it makes you think, definitely, about everything you now watch somebody, we keep on using the phrase, crip up, which is politically correct. That is the phrase we use. That is, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You're allowed to say that, are you?
Yes, well, and the log wasn't politically correct, yeah.
Yeah, so it's fascinating to watch people's reaction, and then you do then say to them, well, that's what Daniel Day-Lewis did, so how is it okay for him to do it and get an Oscar for it and a Golden Globe and a BAFTA or whatever? And yet watching somebody go through that process is very uncomfortable to watch. You know, it's great. But that's the fun of the show, I think. And it's great fun for us as well to watch.
Is it not just the best guy for the job, isn't it? That could be someone who's disabled. And some, it just isn't about your merit.
That's quite a common argument, getting about the best actor for the job. But we all know that unless you've seen every actor in the world, and the world is the same chance to get the job and all of that, but that's never the case. What you've got is, you know, you know the actors that you like to work with, you know your pals, all of that. I mean, it's the same for me casting the show, you know it. Like, if I can get the best actor to work, but I can't look at you. I'm joking, of course, of course.
He scoured the planet.
But ultimately, you know, about having the conversation, I don't know what the answer is. If Daniel Day-Lewis hadn't done that film, we wouldn't be here doing the show. So, you know, there's no simple answer to this, but there are good questions to ask.
National Theatre of Scotland, old hands at the Brighton Festival. I've seen previous performances here, which I absolutely love. How important is it to you to be bringing this show to the Brighton Festival and also in this beautiful setting at the Theatre Royal?
I think it's hugely important. I just think as many people who can see this as possible is a good thing because of the message, but also because it's a great night out. I think it's really entertaining and people are going to really enjoy themselves when they see it. But it's such a clever way, I think, of telling a very important story that as many people can see it as possible is great. And Brighton's such a fantastic city. It's brilliant, and I think they'll really get it. Mm.
So that was what a trio they were. They were a right gang. I love that lot. They were my left right foot's writer and director Robert Softly Gale and actors Richard Conlon and Gail Watson. They were talking to me earlier at the Theatre Royal, and My Left Right Foot opens tonight, runs through to Saturday, 7:30 p.m. with some matinees.
Now you're listening to Radio Reverb 97.2 FM on DAB and online at radioreverb.com. This is the Brighton Festival radio special with Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals.
Some rather spooky music now. This is a Cirque d'Azur. She is doing a live soundtrack to the film Salome. That's going to be at the Old Market later in this month. Channeling her spirit there, that is Cirque d'Azur, aka Hayley Four. She's going to be doing a live soundtrack to the 1923 silent film Salome. That's taking place at the Old Market on Thursday the 23rd. I am a huge fan of live film soundtracks. I'm a huge fan of black and white films as well. Salome looks amazing. I haven't actually seen it. I've seen some clips of it, and it's based around Oscar Wilde's tale of Salome. It's got sets and costumes inspired by Aubrey Beardsley's illustrations for Oscar Wilde's original version of that. I think it's going to be very camp and very decadent. That's the way I like it.
And decadent. Words used to describe Melita. Not. Anyway, you're listening to camp and decadent.
Sometimes.
Okay. Anyway, you're listening to Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM on DAB and online at radioreverb.com. This is the Brighton Festival show. We're live at 5 and we repeat at 10 p.m. and at 9 a.m. the next day. Regular.
Speak for yourself.
Well, you're quite decadent. I'm sure you repeat frequently.
She's lowering the tone now. Right, this is your last call. Last few days to see Distorted Constellations. It's an audiovisual installation by artist Wando Ebizier, which examines the condition known as visual snow. This creates a kind of distortion of visual perception, and it's a relatively unknown condition. And Wando only fairly recently discovered that not everybody sees the world in quite the same way she does. Well, that prompted her to put Distorted Constellations together. It's a maze of mesh with projections and sound, and it's on now until Sunday at Lighthouse. I went there to meet Wando to find out more about the ideas behind it.
My name is Wando Ebizier. This is Distorted Constellations at Lighthouse.
So we're in the basement at Lighthouse, and it's like a maze of light and colour. This is connected to the visual snow syndrome, which is something which you have. How did you discover you had visual snow, and what does it actually mean?
Visual snow syndrome is a disorder that was discovered only a few years ago. I think it was only really named in 2014. And actually around that same time, I just happened to be talking to my parents about, and I said, oh, the sky looks really hazy tonight. And they were like, oh, no, hazy. The sky's not hazy. Maybe you've got cataracts. Go and see the optician. So I went to see the optician and did all the eye tests. They said, your eyes are fine. Your vision's great. And I said at the time, what about all those little dots that I can see? And they were like, maybe you've got dry eyes, try some eye drops. So I tried the eye drops, but it didn't do anything. But I started researching online and just talking to more people and talking about perception in general. I happened to find this paper that had just been written about visual snow, and they realized it's this perceptual disorder. It's not in the eyes, it's neurological. Something seems to be different in some people's brains that means they see all these different things. The weird thing about it is it's not only visual. So there's things like everybody who has visual snow or experiences visual snow will see this kind of like analog TV static all the time. Most people will also have something called palynopsia, which means you see kind of after images. You know, when you look at a light source and look away, you can still see that light source. Yeah, we see these after images of everything. What I find really interesting about it is it's one of those things that demonstrates that how all our perceptual frameworks are really different. And so it's something that a few years ago nobody knew existed. And then since a few scientists have been studying it, there's thousands of people in the world, and it's growing all the time, because it's one of those things that you might not realize until you're an adult and you're suddenly confronted by it, that you realize that not everybody else sees like that. And so it got me really interested in perception in general and how there's lots of kind of like atypical perceptual effects. For example, synesthesia, that someone might go their whole life and not realize that everybody else doesn't smell color or hear color. Like, the real takeaway from this project for me that I'm really interested in people understanding is that actually we all have our own kind of discrete perceptual frameworks, and you really have no idea what somebody else is perceiving.
I've had a wander through here, and it's quite disorientating, not in a scary way, but it does change your perception. You're not sure if you're going forward into a light or into some kind of, there's very soft barriers here of a kind of mesh, and it does really throw out your perception of what you might see as reality.
Good, great. Yeah, I think one thing I wanted to achieve with it is to give people a sense of my perceptual reality and give people a sense of disorientation and a kind of cross-modality of the senses. So scientists are beginning to understand more and more how certain senses interlink, and one sense can confuse another sense. I like this idea of, how the vision and the vestibular sense, which is the sense that governs our kind of uprightness. It's a sense that really goes off key when you're drunk, for example. Okay. How those two things conflicting can impact on each other. And I'm hoping a lot of people come and maybe find out that they're not as normal in inverted commas as they thought they were.
That's Wando Obizie talking about distorted constellations at Lighthouse. It runs from Wednesday to Sunday, noon till 7, and it's free, but this Sunday is the last day. We loved it, didn't we, Rebecca?
Absolutely. I thought it was well worth spending some time there. It's not something... Well, it's something you could just walk in and spend 5 minutes there, but actually it's also something you could walk in and spend an hour and a half.
There's something quite meditative about it, because it is slightly disorientating, and it is something that wraps you up in another world. And in this case, we're getting wrapped up in kind of Wanda's mind and her vision as well. I just really loved it. I thought it was a fantastic experience. And we did actually say when we were talking about it last week that we would go again. So this is kind of a reminder to me that it finishes on Sunday, so I must go again before Sunday.
Absolutely. And that is one of the great things, that we do get to go and see pieces, but we need to be talking about them. I think you were out and about last night. liked, weren't you?
Yeah, I went to see Gonzalez at Brighton Dome. I wasn't sure what to make of this. I mean, I'm a fan of Gonzalez's early work, and his album from 2000, Gonzalez Uber Alice, has never strayed that far from my turntable. And when I played it to people, they're like, what's this? Because it's a kind of mixture of electronica. It's got a bit of a trip hop, a little bit of rapping on it, and kind of down-tempo exotica.
And have you seen him before, like?
I have seen him before, years ago, with Peaches. So a Canadian performance artist, Peaches. Gonzalez is Canadian himself, but lives in Germany now. And he's moved into doing these piano pieces. He won a Grammy for his award, for his work with Daft Punk. So it's obviously extremely popular. I'm not entirely sure about his piano pieces, because to me they're quite pastiche. So they're taking kind of Eric Satie, George Gershwin, Chopin, and stuff like that. And I felt it's a little bit kind of, well, I went with my friend Lorraine and she said library music. So to me, this was a game of two thirds.
But it was divided though.
It was divided up into chunks. So the first third, to me, I mean, it was quite self-indulgent, sort of tinkling on the ivories with what sounded like quite a lot of incidental music to a Sunday night ITV light entertainment drama where there's a kind of a murder in the Cotswolds and everyone goes around in a Morris Minor.
It's been a murder.
And it was a bit like that kind of incidental music. I mean, everyone else was like going wild for it.
Ting, ting, ting.
Yeah, thank you. Go away. I'm speaking. I wasn't totally sure what to expect from that, and I was thinking, like, oh, please let this move on. Thankfully, it did. I mean, after he got out of his system, it really did liven up. He is genuinely a very, very funny performer. So we had an interview with him yesterday. You know, he says, I am an entertainer. And he certainly was entertaining. He did a deconstruction of how Nirvana and Britney write their song. So he was on the keyboard. He's like, this is how you write a song. So you go, da-da-da-da, and then you move it up a little bit. So you go, da-da-da-da, and then you move it down, da-da-da-da. And when he put it all together, we finally got, oh yes, that's Nirvana. He did the same thing with Britney. Genuinely very, very funny. He really took the mickey out of all the people getting up and down all the time going out, that everyone in Brighton has weak bladders. I don't know what all the getting up and down was about. And at the end, he did a rewind of a lot of the parts of the show, and he segued very quickly through the moments for the show that we've already seen. And it was genuinely very, very funny. So I do forgive him for the first part. I did find the first part self-indulgent, but I really enjoyed it. When it all warmed up, and I have to say that Sarah McCoy, the support act, was stunningly good. She was amazing.
Ah, so this is the artist that we heard yesterday that turned me straight to a bottle of red wine.
That's right, and the Gauloises. Yeah. She cracked open the Gauloises. So, yeah, she has got a belter of a voice. I mean, nods towards Nina Simone and Amy Winehouse. Unfortunately, she only played a 20-minute set, and they got the piano tuner in the middle.
It wasn't so her show. It was Chili's show, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know, but whether the piano was a bit out of tune or whether she just bashed it out of tune, I don't know. But sad she only played a 20-minute set. But, overall, good evening. A really good evening. I could have done without the first 20 minutes or so of self-indulgence.
Can we hear that support act again, then?
Yeah, we can. Tell you what, if we can squeeze Sarah McCoy in at the end of the programme, we shall do that.
Lovely.
We shall
lovely.
Do that.
Now, a week is a long time during May in Brighton.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We have mentioned this before, but we're going to touch on it again. It's an exhibition running throughout the festival at Fabrica. The Ghanaian artist Serge Atakwe-Clotty's large-scale installations are meticulously fashioned from discarded 20-litre yellow jerry cans. And Liz Whitehead, Fabrica director, describes the pieces as both very beautiful and politically charged. The exhibition opens up a conversation with the audience on how artists sustain themselves and their communities.
I think the first thing that they will notice is a room full of yellow, beautiful yellow. Atakwe's very kindly organised for all his available works to be here in Brighton, both from America and from Ghana, so that we can really kind of fill the space with his work and create a very kind of immerse the audiences in the work itself. And I think the other wonderful thing is he's extremely happy for people to walk on the work that's on the floor and to touch the work that's on the walls. So I think it'd be a great kind of sensual experience for people. Also, I'm really interested because there's so much to say and learn about Atakwe's work that we then use that experience to take people through into some of the other kind of stories and things that there are to learn about his work.
Now, despite his growing international reputation, the artist continues to base himself and his studio in Labadi, a neighbourhood of the Ghanaian capital, Accra. At that base, Atukwe Kloti has created an innovative and sustainable model for economic and social development, one that both employs local people and is in dialogue with them. Now, when I met with the artist earlier this month, he explained how he challenges assumptions around gender, for example, by himself and his male colleagues dressing in women's clothes when they collected disused jerry cans.
Gender played a very serious role in my work because of my family history of migration and also having to work with the community, you know, because I have a collective about 100 and most of them are women, but in my studio assistants I have only men.
Is one seen as hierarchically higher than the other or just different roles? Is it male roles and female roles or more important roles and less important?
They are both important roles, but based on the process, that it's kind of limited to women, you know, because of the tools and the machines that we use. But when it comes to the weaving or stitching, it's very easy for women to do that. And I'm looking forward to work with more women.
And did you get known as the man who went round in women's clothes ever?
Yeah, I've been very known of that, and I think that it has really brought a lot of attention to think about gender in a very broader way and a very understanding, because back home in our tradition, you know, there are some of the traditional rules that men are not supposed to wear women's clothes. There are family houses where women are not allowed to go there at some point of the year or at some point of the day. And I mean, now we are in a contemporary space and most of this tradition is affecting our life because of modernity, you know, so I'm in question that as an artist, I feel like I use myself as an object or as a subject, and I take the risk, you know, to be able to address that by using myself, because I think that I've actually gained the recognition, and whenever I speak about subjects, it's been discussed and it has all the response, and, you know, I get articles where people read and they understand. So for me, there are a few performances that we have done that is based on gender, and it started with tradition questioning human rights, because human rights is equality. But in our tradition, when your mother or your mom died, her wardrobe is locked up for a year, and after a year, her belongings are given to children. But because I'm the only child and I'm a son, I don't get any of my mom's belongings.
Oh, so it would be daughters, only the daughters would
daughters
get,
and
right.
Mom's siblings, you know. So for me, I felt like there was a disconnection between my mom, because my mom has played a very important role by collecting the gallons for me to work with, or even reaching out to his friends and schools and restaurants to collect them for me. So I thought there was a disconnection, you know. So what I did was I went to my mom's siblings and I told them that I need my mom's clothes to do something. They had no idea what I'm using them for, but, you know, but through social media articles and online platforms, they read about the performance and they felt very disappointed, you know. They felt guilty at some point, so they had to call me. And they have to bring everything back, so it's been shared accordingly. So I got some of my mom's clothes, and I did another series called My Mother's Wardrobe Extension, where I have my mom's belongings that I've kept in my room to be able to connect. And I'm interested in fabric and how fabric has changed over time for traditional into contemporary, because there are very symbolic elements in fabric that has changed, and that is referenced to maybe a situation, is referenced to a landmark or a restaurant, reference to history of the country, you know. So, and I believe that during the performance I was able to include the collective, which it took us a month and a half to convince them to understand that wearing your mom's clothes has nothing to do with sexuality. It's about representing man and how tradition questions human rights and how fabric has changed over time, you know. So based on that interaction, and they begin to understand, and they started wearing clothes, even their mom's clothes from the house. And I realized that most of them are going through the same situation, how tradition questions human rights. So after the performance, it has really brought a lot of understanding, and it has really created kind of freedom, you know, and within the community. And I think for me, that's one of the biggest achievements that I've been able to brought to attention.
Serge Atukwe Kloti there, talking about his work. There's so many layers in what he does to unravel. There really are, and I love his voice too.
It's great, yeah. And I really did like the exhibition at Fabrica, because you do have to know the backstory. It's one of those ones where I think you can't walk into it, because you see the chopped up jerry cans, and it looks like a kind of yellow brick road laid out, and you're kind of, what? what is going on here? So there is a blurb there, and I would strongly advise that you read the blurb, because, like you say, it's got so many different layers, it's got so many different contexts to it, of these jerry cans, which are taken into Ghana from the West, sold to the Ghanaians, filled with oil, then used, like, really kind of toxically as drinking containers. And then he creates them into an artwork, which he brings into the West, and people buy it and pay him for it, and then that money goes back to Ghana. So this kind of two-way flow of trade, it's just asking these questions about that two-way flow.
And it's also art acting for an environmental gain as well, because yeah. what's happened is, instead of people just literally chucking jerry cans into the oceans, they turn up wherever, they are going around and finding them now, and the price that Serge has to pay for a jerry can has gone up about fourfold since he started doing this, because people recognise he's making money. Yeah. He has no problem with that, because yeah. he's making money and it's going back into his community. It's fabulous. And it's at Fabrica. So do you know, read the blurb around as you consider that you're part of this journey of making things better for a community in Ghana. And it's free, and it runs right through to the 26th of May. And I believe Fabrica's open every day, isn't it?
Well, let's have a look. I've just have a quick rummage through the programme, current affairs. Open every day. It's from Wednesday to Saturday is 1 to 6, and Sundays are 2 to 6 p.m. Yeah. That's it.
So with that piece of detail, I think...
That was beautifully delivered, wasn't it?
I think that's an absolutely professional way to end
really
the show.
That's a really professional way to rummage through the programme and find that.
Bang on time. Well, it just shows that's the way to find out information. Never mind us. Pick up your programme, have a look through, and there's still programmes all around town
to grab. Have a rummage.
And you've been listening to the rummaging at Melita Dennett and Rebecca Sandals on the Brighton Festival Show here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, DAB and online, Monday to Friday, live 5 to 6 p.m. during the festival, and repeated at 10 p.m. and 9 a.m. the next day.
And thank you to today's guests, Jamil Olawale Kosoko, Robert Softly Gale, Richard Conlon, Gail Watson, Wando Obizie, Serge Atukwe Clote, and Liz Whitehead. I'm Melita Dennett. Thank you for listening.
And I'm Rebecca Sandals, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow.
We can squeeze in a teensy bit of that Sarah McCoy track we played yesterday. I think it's worth repeating because it's fantastic. Sarah McCoy supporting Gonzalez last night, playing you out on her This Is Sarah McCoy and Beautiful Stranger. From me, I'm Melita. I'm Rebecca. Rebecca. Oh,
so
come on, let's go.
Pop.
Right, let's go. Farewell. See you tomorrow. We'll do all the same things again tomorrow.